The scene is the court of one of the most powerful men on the earth at the time. He was the Pharaoh of Egypt, who ruled over a great people and over an expansive territory. The economy and the technology of Egypt at the time was far more advanced than anyone nearby and most places on the earth. And due to recent events where the wise counsel of a young foreigner who had earned his position to be the chief minister of Egypt next to the Pharaoh, this Egyptian nation was perched to gain even more power because they became the supplier of grain to this part of the world when this part of the world was about to go through a severe famine. And into this regal of all courts stepped a very old man, escorted by his son. His body showed the wear of a shepherd. His face reflected years of hardship. But there was a look of resoluteness about him. And because of recent events, a renewed spark of hope in his eyes, even though he approached the end of his days. Though he had lived as a nomadic shepherd in rural areas, he was now received in the court of Egypt as a dignitary. I'm reading from Genesis chapter 47, verses 7 to 9. Then Joseph brought his father Jacob and presented him to Pharaoh. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Jacob, "How many years have you lived?" So Jacob said to Pharaoh, "The years of my sojourning are 130. Few and unpleasant have been the years of my life, nor have they attained the years that my fathers lived during the days of their sojourning." To this man, a century and three decades now look like a blur. And in light of his ancestors, it looked like a short time. And that statement right there, in a way, summarizes Genesis 12 to 50. And he sums them up as hard. What happened in those 130 trying years? Who was this man standing before Pharaoh? Why was he a welcome guest of this mighty king? Where had he been? What had he done? What had happened to him? What had he seen? And why is he important? And why is he important to us? What should his life mean to us? Well, I want you to go back with me over the next several weeks and relive this man's life as the Holy Spirit, through the biblical text, is our guide and our teacher. And to look at the life of Jacob. He's one of the key figures in early Old Testament of characters that help us to understand not just God's plan, but God and our own relationship with God. And this is an important one, because Jacob was the father of a nation. He has 12 sons that end up being the tribes of Israel, which is the nation in God's plan of work in the Old Testament. He is the man who wrestled with God and man and prevailed. He's the deceiver who actually becomes a man of honor. He's the villain who becomes a hero of faith. So what we're going to do is explore these cherished stories in the last half of the book of Genesis and see how Jacob became Israel. He has two names. Because in a way, he was two people. He was what he began to be, and then he was what God made of him. So why give this kind of attention to Jacob? We're going to look at least five or six sermons about Jacob. And I hate I can't do them in a row. I've got to be out some in April with different obligations. But we'll get to them. And that just gives us more time to soak on Jacob. But I don't believe Jacob has been given his due as far as Bible study is concerned. We tend to look at Jacob as this person after Abraham and before Joseph and see him in light of the Joseph drama, which is so incredible. But I think we've overlooked a lot about Jacob. And so why is it that he deserves such attention and why his story should be noted by us carefully? Well, the amount of text dedicated to Jacob tells us a lot. Jacob comes along in Genesis 25, and he is part of what's going on. Either he's at the front of what's going on, or he's there in the wings all the way to the end of the book. So half the book of Genesis has something to do with Jacob. Not even Abraham's life spans that amount of text, as important as Abraham was. And Jacob, whose name is changed to Israel, then the nation that follows him, the nation that was promised to Abraham, this great nation, this nation bears his name, Israel. It's not called the children of Abraham. They're not called the Abrahamites. They're not named after Moses, the nation of Moses, as important as he is. And I would have you to consider that Abraham and Moses biblically are actually bigger figures in the scheme of things. But for whatever reason, God chooses Jacob and thus Israel for the name of this nation. It's not by accident, is it? Jacob is Israel. Yeah, I already said that. No, I mean Jacob is Israel, the people. The nation is a reflection of him. And it's the prophets who also drive this point home. His name is used among the prophets to depict the nation. A couple of examples. Isaiah chapter 43 says, "But now thus says the Lord, he who created you, O Jacob, he who formed you, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by name. You are mine." In that context, he's talking about the people of Israel. And we get that Israel. We think of the nation of Israel, but here he calls them Jacob. And then there's the passage in Hosea chapter 12. And I want you to look at this. I'm going to read verses 2 to 4 and note how that the man Jacob and the nation Jacob or Israel are used interchangeably. Hosea chapter 12, verse 2. "The Lord also has a dispute with Judah and will punish Jacob according to his ways. He will repay him according to his deeds." Now listen, this is centuries after Jacob lived on earth. "Jacob, I will repay according to your deeds." That's the nation, right? But then look at the next verse. Verse 3, "In the womb, he..." Singular. "He took his brother by the heel. And in his maturity, he contended with God." We're going to read about these today and over the next several weeks, these events. "Yes, he wrestled with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought his favor. He found him at Bethel, and there he spoke with..." Look at your Bibles. "Us." Did you catch that? He wrestled with the angel. He did this. He did that. He wept. And there, he spoke with, God spoke with, not him, but us. And Hosea means the descendants of Israel, or Jacob. Do you see how it's used interchangeably? So there must be some insights we gain about Israel by looking at Jacob. It's another reason why he's so important. We should know something about him, because the people after him will bear his name. And we know how important names are in the Bible. So I want you to understand something about the structure of this series. There will be points along the way where I will stop and make application, but it's not the typical kind of, you know, a preacher reads a text and then he makes 3 points, 3 applications. I'm not going to structure it that way. We'll make application when we look at certain things in Jacob's life to our own experiences, our own decisions. But I want the driving force to be the storyline, the narrative. That's where we will benefit by seeing Jacob, learning about him, seeing what happens to him, and even feeling the experiences that he encounters. I want us to appreciate this as a piece of literature and let the narrative carry us to identify with the characters and especially Jacob and see the sights and feel the emotional pain, tension, excitement, and even relief that is present. I want us to merge with Jacob all over us. A lot of you know that I grew up in a coal mining area. When I was a boy, it was very robust. The mining was very active. And later on, coal mines actually would install showers for men who came out of the mines to clean up before they went home. But a lot of men either didn't use them or some mines didn't have the showers. And so it was not uncommon to go into a store in the evening or at different times of the day, because there were a lot of different shifts, and to see a man completely covered in coal dust, just completely blackened. It was just like common. It was common. No big deal. Because you go into a coal mine and you work an 8-hour or 9-hour shift, you're going to come out of that coal mine covered in coal dust. After several weeks of this, I want us covered with Jacob dust. Now, we know Jacob. We know exactly what happened to him. And we'll be better Bible students from it, but I think we'll be closer to understanding what God wants us to know about some things. It will often be clear that where Jacob stood, we've stood there, or will one day stand. That the mistakes he made have been mistakes that we've made, or yet could make. And that we'll see that God was working in his life, as unusual and complicated as it will become, and oftentimes because he made it complicated, sometimes because somebody else did, that God was working in his life, and he works in ours. So I want us to go back in our Old Testaments, the land of Canaan, into the tents of a man named Isaac. Because as we're introduced to this son of Isaac, we understand that this is a baby, a boy, a man of destiny. In Genesis chapter 25, we have this statement, which is a transitional statement, but also a stake in the ground. Genesis 25, verse 19. Now these are the records of the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham became the father of Isaac. God chose Abraham to receive great blessings, and we have seen in our readings, in our studies, how God has blessed him, and that ultimately that one day God will use Abraham's descendant as an avenue of a greater blessing to all nations and all families of the earth, as he would provide or offer salvation through Abraham's descendant, Jesus the Christ. And these blessings would flow through this family, and initially they're passed from Abraham to Isaac, who was born to Abraham when Abraham was 100 years old. What an impression Abraham would have had on Isaac. Imagine having a 100-year-old dad. I mean, you're a child. stories of leaving the homeland of Ur and the miraculous birth to Abraham and Sarah and the sacrifice that was halted. We understand these stories would have been passed down from Abraham to Isaac and onward because we see the Israelites speak of them and write of them later. What a heritage is being passed on. And now it goes from Abraham to Isaac to his children. In Genesis 25, verse 20, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, which we studied this morning in the class, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban the Aramean, to be his wife. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren. And the Lord answered him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. Abraham was promised that his descendants would be as numerous as the stars of heaven and the sand on the seashore. But boy, was God slow in bringing that about. We first have Sarah's barrenness, which went on for decades. And now we have Rebekah's barrenness. It's like, for this whole thing to ride on heirs being produced, why all these women who can't have babies? We're told that Isaac and Rebekah married when Isaac was 40 years old. We're told later in this text here that the babies don't come until he's 60. That's a 20-year wait. Isaac and Rebekah waited 20 years for a child. But we have these barren couples in the Bible. And they all had a destiny, and their offspring had a destiny. There's Isaac and Rebekah here. Before that, Abraham and Sarah with Isaac. There's Jacob and Rachel later on who produced Joseph. There's Hannah with Samuel. There's Elizabeth and Zechariah in the New Testament. And their son John, the forerunner to the Christ, John the Baptist. And Isaac is said here to have pleaded with the Lord for a birth to occur. Well, at least he and Rebekah didn't make the mistake that Sarah and Abraham made by trying to introduce a third party like they did with Hagar. But it's interesting how that, according to God's promises, Isaac should expect a child through this Rebekah. Because we saw this morning in the class, Rebekah was chosen to be his wife, right? By God. We could say that in light of how things unfolded. But even though he should have full expectation that Rebekah would have a child to complete these promises, Isaac still prays to God and he pleads with God for the child to come. You see, God's promises to us do not negate our need to plead with God for them. Jesus is coming one day. You know what we say to that? Come, Lord Jesus. Even what we know regarding what God will do, God wants us to pray to him about it. Isaac does. And she conceives. And lo and behold, she doesn't have one. She's got two. If ever the term double trouble applied, it's with these two rascals. Verse 22 to 23, but the children struggled together within her. And she said, if it is so, why then am I this way? So she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, this is Rebekah, two nations are in your womb. And two peoples will be separated from your body. And one people shall be stronger than the other. And the older shall serve the younger. Here we have a new message to the patriarchs. It's what we call Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They had been told, Abraham had, and Isaac had been told that a mighty nation would come from them. Now, Isaac and Rebekah initially are told that two nations will come from them. And there's something about these two nations. They won't get along. And the struggle of the babies in the womb symbolize that. And there's something else odd about this. Of the two, the younger would be the superior. The younger would rule over the older. That's not the way it was supposed to work. There was a very strong ancient Eastern custom, and actually a custom similar to it in almost every civilization up until modern times, that the older would be the head of the family, and that the older would be the most prosperous of the family, receiving the greatest inheritance, and the older would be the torchbearer for the family. But where would the blessings of Abraham lodge? Where would the promises lodge in this case? From what the Lord is saying, it's going to be with the younger. He's going to rule over his brother. And it was Rebekah who was told this. We can safely assume that this was shared with Isaac. But it was Rebekah who was first given this prophecy. And so we have a baby of destiny. Such passages like this and others teach us that God authors our lives as human beings. These people in Genesis are very aware of it, more so than probably we are. Now, we should not overreact to the Calvinist teaching of predestination, that God selects who's saved and who's not, and either you're among the elect or you're not. It's not a biblical doctrine. There is the elect that God chooses to save, but it's those who choose to save. It's those, like in Acts chapter 2, who call upon the Lord for salvation. But that doesn't mean God doesn't author our lives. And if God is authoring our life, then he has a plan for our life, and he has a destination, thus a destiny for us. Whether we even believe in God or not, God is authoring our lives. We see that in so many Old Testament characters who are very ungodly people. God's using them. Our choices that we make out of our own free will, that's going to determine whether God's plan is going to be a blessing to us or a curse to us. Do you possess a sense of destiny? Now, I'm not talking about being famous. You know, you stand in front of the mirror with a guitar and you snarl your lip and you think, I'm going to be somebody someday, you know, that kind of thing. That's not what I'm talking about. You know, it's some kid who's hustling lemonade on the street corner and he thinks, yeah, I'm going to be a CEO one day of a multi-billion dollar company. That's not what I'm talking about. It's not about being famous or performing mighty deeds. It might be a very ordinary life. But when we submit to God's will and allow him to work in our lives, he weaves us into his plan for good. And my little life and your little life can be part of God's large, wondrous and momentous plan. And we need that awareness and the meaning and the direction that it brings. And here Sarah is told about Jacob's destiny. Though they don't know yet who's going to be the younger of the two. But now we learn when we see the birth or the births of these two. In verse 24, when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in the womb. Now the first came forth red, all over like a hairy garment, and they named him Esau, which is similar to the Hebrew term hairy. Afterward, his brother came forth with his hand holding on to Esau's heel. The first thing we're told about Jacob is he's got a hold of his brother's foot. It's all very symbolic. So his name was called Jacob. And Isaac was 60 years old when she gave birth to them. I'm 62. I cannot imagine what it would be like to live with two-year-old boys. Isaac, he had a lot of servants, so there we go. It would take it, wouldn't it? First out was this red and hairy boy whom they named Esau. And the second emerged. We know elsewhere he didn't look like his brother. From this text here and from something that happens later on, he didn't look like his brother. His condition of his body was different. They're fraternal twins, not identical. And he's got a hold of Esau's heel. Based upon the prophecy already given to Sarah, with him a hold of his brother's heel, this is no coincidence. This entanglement of them in the womb tossing about, it's no coincidence. It symbolized their relationship. And it also represented Jacob's personality, this younger son. They call him Jacob, and this is an interesting expression. It means at the hills. You ever been running a race when you were a kid and you turn around, you hear somebody right behind you, they're right on your heels, they're about to overtake you? That's Jacob. It means overreaching. You're in this place, but you're trying to reach and get something in the other place ahead of you. Thus, literally, it means supplanter. He's trying to get in somebody else's place. And later on, the name becomes synonymous with deceiver. Because how can you get in somebody else's place? Well, one way to do it is by deceit. And it's like this. This is the kid. Jacob is the kid that's trying to grab your cookie. He's the kid that's trying to cut line in front of you. But as Jacob is further described as he ages, he's slick about it. It's like you turn this way and you're like, where'd my cookie go? It's that kind. It's not the bully who comes up and says, give me your cookie. He's the kind that you turn your head and he grabs it. Or you turn your head and next thing you know, he's in front of you in line. So we have some thematic indicators that really rise to the surface here that we see repeated in the book of Genesis. Barrenness, struggle, sibling rivalry. And these are repeated patterns in the book of Genesis. Because you know what? Life works that way, doesn't it? Isn't life the same old problems over and over? The same old challenges. And thus we see it in Genesis from generation to generation to generation. So these boys grow. We're given so much in such a tight text here. In verse 27, when the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the field. But Jacob was a peaceful man, living in tents. Now Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Contrast of these two sons, these brothers. Esau's the hunter. Why a hunter? I want you to see that this was more of a lifestyle than an occupation. Because what did Abraham and Isaac have in abundance? Sheep, goats. They had all kinds of meat. Now, hunting takes place when you have to forage for your meat, or as in modern times, because guys just like to do it. Esau didn't have to forage for meat, but he was a man of the field. You know, you can see a statue of him in front of the Bass Pro Shop or something. You know, with camouflage and a bow and arrow and a fishing rod. I mean, that's his personality. He's a man of the field. He's adventuresome. He's carefree. He likes freedom. And you think, well, how are you reading all of that? You let this story play out and you'll see this, all these things with him. You know, there's something about when you study about people like a Daniel Boone, you're like, yeah, poor old Daniel Boone. He had to go on these long hunts and find all this game everywhere. Yeah, there was a need for it, but Daniel Boone loved that. That was his personality. He loved to go into the woods and be gone for months at a time. He loved it. That's where he was comfortable. There's just some people like that. That frontier personality. That's Esau. And as a result of that, you think about how his family lived. His family lived migrating in tents, taking care of flocks and herds. That's sort of an ordered life. Those flocks and herds, they need attention all the time. He's a man of the field. He's not concerned with convention. And we'll see later on regarding his marriages, how that he bucks the trend. He's not concerned about, well, what one ought to do. This is what you ought to do. That's not Esau's mode of operation. And this passage here is all about contrast. Jacob, well, Jacob's different. The English Standard and the American Standard Version says he's a quiet man. The New King James says he's a mild man. The King James says he's a plain man. And I think it was the earlier New American Standard that says he's a peaceful man. Okay? And so does this New American does. So that's quite a wide variety there. Quiet, mild, plain, peaceful. This term originally, and this is pulling from really a great standard on Hebrew words called Brown Driver Briggs, says that this is describing a personality that is sound. An ordinary, quiet sort of person. So again, here's Esau, here's the outdoorsman. Here's Jacob, who lives in tents. He's the man of convention. He's the man of society, and he's got this calm life. An outdoorsman is anything but quiet and calm. They're a robust personality. Jacob has a calm personality. He's the solid citizen. He's the level-headed, steady one. But remember what else we're told about him. He's Jacob. He's the supplanter. He's the one who's grabbing at the hills. And again, how does he do it? He's slick. We'll see that played out in a couple of episodes. We should also note this, that though it says he's a man of tents and his mother loved him, we're not to see him as a wimpy mama's boy. But he does have a connection to her, as Esau, according to the text, has a connection to Isaac. And thus we see favoritism. It's very pronounced here in this family. The text says so. Isaac is fond of Esau. Well, there's one reason why that would be apparent, as it is in this kind of culture. He's the firstborn son. Now, he's only firstborn by a very narrow margin, since he has a twin, but he's the firstborn. But that counts. First out, first up. So, of course, the dad is going to have this affinity for the firstborn son. But we're told in the text that he liked Esau's game. He liked to eat what Esau would go and hunt. And we all understand that there is a difference between domestic meat and wild meat. And certain people like that kind of gamey flavor, as we'll say today. Which meant he would have been all about Esau's outdoor life. But in spite of his personality that we will find to be unstable, very soon, Isaac preferred Esau. Rebekah loved Jacob. Why? Maybe there's some kind of personality meshing there. Maybe because he's around the tents, he's around more. But for sure, we know what? She received the prophecy that it would be the younger, as it turned out to be Jacob, who would actually be the strong one to rule. So if she's believing in the Lord, she's going to believe that somehow or another, Jacob is the prominent one. And as a mother, she would have kept that close to her heart, because it's Rebekah who's concerned that the babies are churning inside of her, and she wants to understand this, and the mother is given this answer. And it's going to be Rebekah's zeal for Jacob that will lead her to cross some lines. Wouldn't be the only mother who fudged and crossed lines for a favorite child. And as we'll see in the case of Rebekah, there's always a prize. Wow, we got some bad seeds being sown here. These parents were playing favorites. In parental favoritism, it's usually selfish. A parent will say, oh, I just have this, you know, I just love this child so much, but usually it's a selfish motive. There's something that they're seeing in that child that reflects them. There's something they're wanting to see happen because of that child or for that child. It's usually selfish motivation that fuels favoritism. After all, the text tells us, why does Isaac favor Esau? The food. And that will play prominent in the next episode, one after the one we're about to look at. And favoritism will always do its damage, even with grandchildren. Most people in the family are not like, yeah, that's okay with me. That's not how people are. And this favoritism will be like rapidly spreading seeds. It's going to crop up again and again, not just in Isaac's family, but in Jacob's family. Which brings us to the first very revealing episode between the two sons. Starting in verse 29. When Jacob had cooked stew, Esau came in from the field, and he was famished. You get that picture right there? Jacob's among the tents. He's there in society where there's food abundantly. Esau's been somewhere where resources are scarce, and he comes in exhausted and famished. See the contrast there? When Jacob had cooked the stew, verse 30, and Esau said to Jacob, please let me have a swallow of that red stuff there, for I'm famished. Therefore, his name was called Edom. Red, what Edom means. But Jacob said, first, sell me your birthright. Esau said, behold, I'm about to die. So of what use then is the birthright to me? And Jacob said, first swear to me. So he swore to him. And Jacob sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went on his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Now, Was this an ambush? Or was this perchance, just something that's a transaction that happened coincidentally? It's hard to know. We do know this. What was premeditated was that Jacob was so quick to go there, he had his eyes planted on the birthright. Because after all, who is he? He's the supplanter. He's been on Esau's heels trying to take his place ever since they came out of the womb. And he has Esau sized up. We would say today he's got his number. And Esau reveals so much of himself in a few words. There in the New American Standard, it says, "Let me have a swallow of that red stuff there." Other translations say, "The red stew. For I'm famished." What's driving Esau? His physical desires. Physical desires are natural to the human body. But when physical desires are elevated, it's a dangerous condition. His physical desires are completely ruling him. He's not logical. He says in verse 32, he's about to die. Now, come on, was he about to die? Somebody's been out hunting in the field, had a dry run, comes back tired and hungry. He's talking. He's functioning. He's not about to kill over and die. But his logic is all fogged over by his desires. He is without measurable self-control. And this is not a read-in. This continues to be his personality in other incidents. He has no measurable self-control. We'll keep seeing proof of that. The birthright. This is so among these ancient peoples that the oldest son would have the birthright, which meant he would get a double portion of the inheritance. He would get way more than any of the children. And he would become, after the death of the father, the head of that family or that tribe. And in the case of Abraham's family, that would mean the spiritual head on the reception of these promises. But birthright was a common thing. We're going to see next episode about the blessing. That was an Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Esau thing to that family. But the birthright was a status given to the oldest son in these families. And Jacob, though he was second born, what? He wants it. And in the narrative, it passes judgment on Esau. When it says, Esau thus despised his birthright. Esau didn't appreciate being the firstborn, did he? He didn't respect the importance of leading the family. He didn't even value the physical possessions that should come his way. Why? Because right now he's hungry and those physical possessions are years away. He wants that red stuff right now. And there is a commentary on Esau in the New Testament, as we've seen elsewhere in some of our earlier character studies. The book of Hebrews comments on these people, but this time it's chapter 12, outside the list of the faithful. And it says this, reading in this context, starting in verse 14, "Strive for peace with everyone and for the holiness without which no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one falls to obtain the grace of God." So this is describing the godly person. "That no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble." Now, you don't want to be this person. "And if by it many become defiled," this bitterness, "that no one is sexually immoral or unholy like Esau." Now, why is Esau an example here? Who sold his birthright for a single meal? English Standard calls him unholy. New American, godless. New King James calls him profane. This term in the original Greek here, bibilos, literally means crossing a threshold. You've crossed a line. It's commonly used in the Old Testament as well as the New Testament to describe the heathen and the wicked and the godless person. Esau revealed his true colors here by trading his birthright for a single meal. He didn't care about what was valuable. He didn't care about the things of God. He was on the other side of the door from the things of God. Here's on this side of the door, the things of God, what God values, what God will give you. He's on the other side. He's across the threshold. And why? Because he's driven by his physical desires. Is it believable that a person would trade away a privileged family position, which in this family included momentous spiritual blessings? Would he trade all that away for red stuff? Yeah, he did. And people will do that. This is what can happen to your thinking when your fleshly desires get loose. Like David did with Bathsheba. Look what David gave away and risked and damaged for one night with Bathsheba. Or like Judas did for 30 pieces of silver. We look at such incidents and we're like, what was David thinking? What was Judas thinking? What was Esau thinking? What are we thinking? When some physical desire drives us to lose our head and get on the other side from where God is. That's Esau. Okay. But what about our man Jacob? What does it say about him? Well, it says that he recognized the importance of the birthright. That possibly he's aware of this destiny that has been prophesied for him, that came through his mother, that he would be the stronger and the ruler in the family. And especially thinking, well, I deserve that way more than this uncouth, smelly brother of mine. And we see that Jacob is showing that he can value in the long run what's important. But aren't you left with a bad taste in your mouth about Jacob at this point? It's not so much what he valued, it's how he went about trying to get it. And we've seen people in the book of Genesis make that mistake before, haven't we? Esau was foolish, even godless. However, Jacob was manipulative, even wickedly so. He took advantage of his brother in his physical weakness. If your brother comes in from the field hungry and you've got a pot of stew, what do you do? Duh. He preyed upon Esau's weakness. You see that? Esau's got weaknesses. Instead of trying to help his brother, he preyed upon his weakness for his own benefit. He made a grossly inequitable trade, as Hebrews 12 indicates it. There's nothing fair in that trade. Jacob reveals major character flaws here. He comes across sly, even a little creepy. You better watch your back with Jacob. Because, again, we're not squeezing too much out of this. Because we'll see that he'll act in even a more sly manner to get what he wants. Next time. And what will happen next? Well, as the story begins here, Jacob seems to be on course to becoming a conniving villain. If he did this to his brother, what would he do to anybody? But how many times have you read a book or watched a film to be turned off to a character, repulsed to a character, and then to watch things change? and the character experiences redemption. And you actually develop affections for the character. Ebenezer Scrooge? Darth Vader? I remember he's dying the first time I saw it. And I'm thinking, oh, I never thought I'd tear up for Darth Vader. Is there anything redeemable in this Jacob who would do his brother this way, his weak brother? Is there something in Jacob that God saw and he wants to draw it out in time after he has taught Jacob some hard lessons and refined him? On our journey with Jacob, we'll see that the tension between him and his brother will only increase. It will get worse, far worse. And as a result, Jacob's life will become so complicated, so hard. But all are those are the necessary ingredients for God's recipe to take Jacob and turn him into Israel. I sure am looking forward to what we'll see next. Brother Hilton has another song for us to sing together. And if there is one who wants to respond to the call of the gospel of Jesus Christ in obedience to that gospel, then we'll certainly be so happy to assist you. If you need to do that, you can let it be known as we stand and sing.